turns out there are a lot of people in this country who don't put on MAGA hats, who don't consider themselves Bernie bros, and who find that their political opinions are somewhat complex, that they're progressives over here on some issues, on health care and whatnot, but they're not necessarily with Elizabeth Warren when it comes to, you know, banking regulation or something, who find themselves with an eclectic set of opinions. And those are the sorts of individuals that we appeal to.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. Jerry Taylor is the founder and president of the Niskanen Center, a think tank that has found itself a very important place in American politics and policy. Jerry is a former conservative who concluded that climate change was real and caused by humans and left his longtime position at the Cato Institute. He has made the Niskanen Center a haven for anti-Trump Republicans and libertarians and a place for developing progressive policy that uses methods that conservatives can support, like market-based solutions to global warming. We had a great conversation, and I think you should listen to it. So, after a word from our sponsor, my interview with Jerry Taylor of the Niskanen Center.
This episode is brought to you by Graphicacy. Graphicacy is an analytic design firm that can help you advance the mission of your organization using your own real data and information. They are 21st century visual communicators who create interactive graphics, motion graphics, and data visualizations. You can find Graphicacy at graphicacy.com. That is GRAPHICACY.com. With Graphicacy's help, you can visualize a better world.
Hi, Jerry. Would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Yeah, sure. My name is Jerry Taylor. I'm the president and co-founder of the Niskanen Center, which is a public policy think tank in Washington, D.C. As far as a biography is concerned, I grew up in a lot of different places moving around with my parents, but more or less can claim Iowa is my home state, though that's still somewhat tenuous. I began as a political operative in 1980 for Republican causes, the campaign for Ronald Reagan and the presidency in 1980, Chuck Grassley's campaign for the United States Senate in 1980, which was his first victory on that front. And then I went to college with the idea of becoming a right-wing political operative, but I kept juggling political activities during that time, never actually graduated from college. Left after 3 years to come to Washington to become the next Karl Rove. And it turns out that me and 10,000 people had that ambition. Through chance in some way, I ended up at a public policy advocacy organization called the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is a 800-pound right-wing gorilla in state politics. Got the job because I knew a lot of Republican politicians, of course, at the time. And that's how my think tank career began. After a few years at ALEC, I ended up at the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C., which is probably the premier libertarian think tank in the country. Spent 21 years there before leaving to start the Niskanen Center. So since you asked, I tell.
It's not the standard biography for people on my podcast, though I've had a fair number of sort of never Trump Republicans of late. I'm kind of curious about that path. You did a lot of journalism in college also, writing for the more conservative publication at your school.
Yeah, well, I founded a newspaper called the Hawkeye, or co-founded a newspaper called the Hawkeye Review, which then became the Iowa Review, I believe. It was one of those spate of right-wing newspapers that were pretty popular back in the day. My counterparts at Dartmouth started the Dartmouth Review a few years earlier, and I actually got to know Laura Ingraham and Dinesh D'Souza in college in the course of the networks that were out there for these sorts of right-wing college newspapers. But that was a long time ago, and I have long left that world. Unfortunately, Laura Ingraham just got deeper and deeper into it.
Yep. So tell me about that path out of that world? Because most people, not all people, but most people seem to, you know, if they grow up as an operative of one side, they pretty much run a whole career that way, as Laura has. What changed for you?
Well, you know, most people when they're young, it's been my observation, are pretty much carbon copies of either their parents' political beliefs or their peers' political beliefs in high school. My mother was a Nixon-styled Republican. My father was definitely a George Wallace-styled populist. If he wasn't a member, he certainly should have been a member of the John Birch Society back in that day. So I grew up in rural Iowa in a world of, you know, a pretty hardcore new right. My father was also more often than not a rather devout evangelical Christian. And so, you know, I came out of the sociocultural right back in that day and then found myself in college with a whole lot of people who didn't think like I did. And so, in other words, the kind of culture you see from right-wingers, say, at UCal Berkeley, who invite Milo Yiannopoulos or whatever his name is to come do performance theater in school just to trigger the left. You know, there's nothing new about that. And that's what I was engaged in at the University of Iowa as well. But, you know, I left it because as I became more involved in politics, I noticed a few things. First of all, working for conservative Republicans was not always obviously fighting for the truth and the light in a Manichaean struggle of good versus evil. I mean, that's the way activists think about politics too often. And I became a bit disillusioned with the kind of political actors I had proposed to dedicate my life to electing. And second of all, the more educated you become, the more you read, the more, if you're intellectually alive, you begin to question some of your ideas. And so I went from an extremely hardcore new right sociocultural warrior of the most toxic sort to then becoming a bit more of a mainstream Buckleyite conservative in the old National Review sense, and would probably comfortably park myself in that world until maybe the mid to late 1980s when extensive exposure to Republicans, even the more sane type, left me somewhat cold. And then that brought me into the world of libertarianism, where I found myself for most of my adult life. I then eventually gave that up as well. So you can say I've wore a lot of clothes over my day, but most of the time they've been clothes garbed from the right.
What's the sort of founding story for the Niskanen Center? It sounds like a number of people left Cato and elsewhere to do this. How did that all come about?
Well, at start, there were only a few of us. Eventually, a number of people left Cato and other right-wing think tanks to join the Niskanen Center, but it didn't happen all at once. There's probably maybe about six reasons I left Cato to start the Niskanen Center. The first reason is that for the most part, even though I eventually rose to become a vice president at the Cato Institute with a portfolio of policy work that was pretty much mine to choose from. But the reality is I was brought in at Cato and spent most of my career there in charge of our energy and environmental policy work. And that meant I was hip deep in climate politics and policy for the most part. And originally, I began my work at Cato as a climate skeptic. And over the course of a couple of decades, my mind slowly changed on that front until by the last few years, I had completely flipped and become someone who, you know, had faith in the scientific narratives offered by mainstream climate scientists, and fully convinced of the need for ambitious policy to respond to climate risk. But there was no room for that at the Cato Institute. So pretty hard to be overseeing climate policy work when you don't believe in the work you're overseeing. So that's one reason I left. The second was a related matter. I found that increasingly the Institute was involved in dogmatic empirical debates that had nothing to do with underlying principles. So as an example, there's a hot discussion about the increasing economic inequality in the United States. Now, a libertarian can accept increasing inequality and still defend free market capitalism, or they might accept increasing inequality and appreciate the political economy that follows from that, which would not be very good for society, and think about libertarian-friendly means of addressing it, or they might disagree that there's increasing inequality at all. But, you know, the empirical question of whether there's increasing inequality in the United States, wealth inequality, it's just an empirical question. And where you fall on that in that debate shouldn't really be an ideological matter. It either is or it isn't. But libertarians, and this not just a knock on libertarians, I think this is probably universally the case, whether you're talking about people on the left or the right, they want to believe convenient narratives. So if you're a libertarian, it's not convenient to believe that relatively loosely regulated free market capitalism is going to produce a whole heck of a lot of Dickinsonian inequality, right? So you spend a lot of your time arguing it's not there. Over and over and over again, Cato was prioritizing policy arguments and debates that had nothing to do with underlying principles. They had to do with the implications of empirical matters that were not in the slightest bit ideological, but because they had implications for the worldview at the Cato Institute, we were finding ourselves dying on these hills over and over again. And I became increasingly unimpressed by the arguments that we were offering. And, you know, if you're unimpressed and increasingly left cold by your think tank, you probably should find a new think tank. And there was no think tank out there in the United States that kind of reflected my views. So I thought I'd go ahead and build one. The other few reasons is that I thought Cato's theory of policy change was incorrect. Their idea was that if you want to change public policy, you have to change public opinion, because politicians are vote maximizing actors. They mostly are concerned about reelection. So if you want them to vote this way or that way or the other way, you need to make it politically critical for them to do so. How do you do that? Well, you change public opinion in their districts. It's a good story, and it makes a lot of sense. And there is some truth to these claims, but if you do a deep dive in the political science literature, you'll find absolutely no correlation whatsoever between changes in public opinion and changes in public policy. It's not to say public opinion is important. It is. But can it drive in and of itself changes in public policy? No, it can't. And so I thought a think tank that was serious about policy change needed to be serious about Washington, D.C., less than communications. And then finally, at the Cato Institute, there was a change in leadership near the end of my time there. And this followed a grand shootout between the management at the Cato Institute and the board of directors and Charles Koch, who was a co-founder of the Cato Institute. And there was a year-long dispute that ended with a negotiated settlement, which the short version of which is that the Cato Institute would be a little bit more inclined to working in a friendly fashion with the Koch network and the GOP at large. And I'm not sure I would characterize Cato that way today. In fact, I don't think I would. But back at that time, it looked to me that the Institute was becoming more Republican friendly than I was comfortable with. And so for all of those reasons, it signaled a pretty good time for me to move on and think about establishing my own organization.
And so tell me about the kind of early days. I'm always interested in people who put together new organizations. I think of them as political entrepreneurs in this space. But like, what were you trying to build, and how'd you get it going, and how did it evolve over time?
Well, there are two things I wanted to accomplish with the Niskanen Center at launch when I left the Cato Institute. The first thing was to revive an intellectual tradition that had been kind of lost in the libertarian world, which is a sort of left libertarianism that took seriously issues like social justice. When most people think of libertarians, they think of Ayn Rand, or they think of Hayek, or they think of Milton Friedman or Rothbard or ideologues like that. That's a major part of, you know, a lot of libertarian thought. But on the other hand, if you read John Stuart Mill on liberty, you'll get a whole different version of libertarian concern. You'll see John Stuart Mill as concerned about social injustices as libertarians are, you know, concerned about the horrors of licensing Korean nail polishers or something like that. It turns out that there is a creed that takes libertarians seriously that would argue that actually you can find defenses for things like affirmative action in libertarian thought. You can find defenses for reparations for slavery in libertarian thought. You can find libertarians, including Hayek, who believed in universal health care. You can find, in other words, just because you believe that liberty is the most important consideration in American politics doesn't necessarily lead you to Koch land. It can lead you into a rather progressive place as well. There are a number of libertarian academics who think this way, but there was virtually no organization in the United States institutionally that forwarded that argument. And so we hope to do that. It was sort of to take a page from an operation that is recently deceased called the Bleeding Heart Libertarian Blog, where a number of libertarians who thought along those lines had banded together. We were somewhat inspired by them. So that was the first objective in starting the Niskanen Center, was to revive that sort of heterodox left libertarian school of thought. The second was to take seriously how policy change actually happens. And very few think tanks, in my estimation, really do that. As I mentioned earlier, there is a theory of policy change that the libertarian world had embraced, but a lot of other people embrace it too. I mean, Tom Steyer seems to embrace it. People who invest heavily in grassroots activism and public opinion implicitly sort of are embracing that sort of model of policy change. But in reality, policy change is ridiculously hard because there are numerous choke points in American politics where political minorities can stymie political majorities. Filibusters in the Senate, the bottleneck within leadership in a highly concentrated House or Senate. You know, there are all sorts of ways that if someone wants to block policy change, they can do so even if very few people in the United States agree with them. A great example of that is the NRA. The NRA's policy agenda is wildly unpopular. But gun control is fiendishly difficult to pass. It doesn't matter whether the public surveys find that 70-odd% of people believe in this, that, or the other. It doesn't matter. The NRA has political networks in Washington. They're extremely powerful. And so as a think tank, of course, can't be like the NRA. Their source of power is not the source of power that could be marshaled by a think tank. But one of the things we know through theory and practice is that with Congress so wildly under-resourced, they don't have staff, they don't have a lot of research budget. I mean, your average congressman or senator is asked to do a tremendous number of things, and they have very few resources to do it, personal resources or informational resources. And so a think tank which is engaged in providing what political scientists call legislative subsidy can really have a lot of influence. What that basically means is you're a free staff resource. You go to members and their staff, and you basically allow yourself to provide free services. And in the course of educating members about public policy and providing research and creative thought with regards to policy design, you can have a lot of influence on the policy process. And there's also a network subsidy that can follow from that. I mean, you'd be amazed at how little offices talk with one another. I'd be meeting with a congressman or a senator, and they'd say, well, this seems like a good idea, but I really don't think that Senator so-and-so would go for it, and he's pretty important on this front. And I just got done having a meeting with Senator so-and-so a week ago when they were saying that this is an excellent idea, but they're not entirely sure the senator I'm talking to would go along. And here they are not communicating. And so a policy organization that involves itself in the governing networks of Washington on Capitol Hill can actually do quite a bit.
Can you sort of trace the growth of your center? How did you find people to work there? What were you looking for? And what sort of areas have you tackled to be influential?
We didn't launch with a sack of money from a billionaire who gave us seed cash to go out and prove our worth. It was a struggle to raise money for launch. I think when we opened our doors in January of 2015, we had a few $100,000 we had raised in the bank, enough operating cash for maybe 3 months, and that was it. So we had 3 months to prove ourselves and find some more money. So under a world like that, you're not going to get the best and the brightest, because that's a hell of a gamble, right? You're going to go join an organization that may not even be here by, you know, late spring. So the people who joined me in launching the Niskanen Center were close friends and acquaintances who I had gotten to know primarily through the Cato Institute, who believed in this mission and really wanted to give it a go. And it worked. We were able to slowly demonstrate that our ideas with regards to how best to move policy on Washington actually had some merit to it. And there were a lot of people, you know, in my old world who likewise were either disgruntled by the libertarian movement at large, or were not being, or were too heterodox for the organizations they were working in. And they slowly started migrating to the Niskanen Center. It was a hard and a slow slog, but since that time, we've become one of the more prominent think tanks in the city, and that's something I'm extremely proud of.
I would imagine. What are the areas that you guys mostly specialize in?
Well, when we first started, you mean with a couple of $100,000, you can't deal with everything. So we were very careful about what issues we wanted to tackle. We started out realizing that as libertarians at the time, I don't think I'd describe us that way now, but back in the day, as heterodox libertarians anyway, we knew Republicans. We'd spent all our lives working essentially with Republicans. We can speak their language. We understand, you know, how they think. We have personal relationships and networks there. We didn't know very many people on the Democratic side of the aisle or in the left, but we knew a lot of people on the right. And so a think tank can choose to do one of two things. It can be an ammo shop for its allies, or it can try to move its allies into a better place. I'd had no interest in just being a huzzah ammo shop for our allies, because one, as heterodox as we were, we found we didn't have a whole lot of allies on policy in the Republican Party. We had some, but not as many as we'd like. And second of all, there were a lot of places where we thought the major challenges in American politics were to move Republicans into a better place where ideologically they could justify the move. So, for instance, there were then and still are a number of Republicans who are fairly liberal when it comes to immigration policy. The entire party is not Stephen Miller and Donald Trump on this issue. They've gone quiet, but there's still a lot of Republicans who are interested in a far more humane and a far more open immigration policy. Likewise, there are a number of Republicans who are genuinely concerned about climate change, want to do something about it. They're just not entirely sure what the policy response ought to be. And there are good libertarian conservative reasons why someone might move towards climate action. After all, conservatives are about protecting property rights, right? Well, that's what climate change policy is all about. It's about protecting people's property from a disaster that is not of their own making. There's no reason a conservative ought to oppose that. And plus, how conservative is it to play dice with the future of the planet? That's not conservative in the slightest. So we chose initially four issues to get involved in: immigration policy, climate policy, health and welfare policy, and technology policy, because these were all areas where we saw the possibility for transpartisan alliances and where we could move the Republican Party into better places. And so we wanted to be an engine for change and not just a huzzah think tank for people who already agreed with us, which is very unusual. Most think tanks essentially are finding an ideological or political silo and then churning out ammo for their allies to use in political combat. And that's not what we wanted to do.
So it sounds like the rise in the election and the governance of Trump must have really affected you. Can you describe how that might have changed your institute?
Yeah, it had a huge impact. I mean, so we were an organization at launch at Niskanen that was primarily interested in policy change. We were not interested in moving public opinion. We were not particularly interested in ideological evangelism or offering our own codicil for what libertarianism ought to look like or anything, though we do write about that occasionally, and it's at least dead. But primarily it was about actual concrete policy change, demonstrating how we can effectively get a bill from the germ of an idea in our think tank into actual law. And so if that's your business, and especially if you're dealing with Republicans and Democrats who were not already ideological allies, it doesn't do you any good to go preaching on a street corner or raging on Twitter or Facebook about ideological matters, right? Better to just stick with your knitting, which is what we tried to do at Niskanen until the election of Donald Trump. Particularly since we're dealing with Republicans, it's probably not the best idea to start putting on the face paint about party leadership. But with the election of Donald Trump, it seemed to us that more was at stake now. What good does it do if, because of our relationships in the Trump administration, we can move positive policy on technology and the regulation thereof as we become an authoritarian state? Making the trains run on time in fascist countries is not something you want to look back on fondly as your life's accomplishment. And so given how alarmed we were at the danger that not only Donald Trump, but the movement that coalesced around him, this populist nationalism that has now taken over the GOP, we felt that it was critical that we engage, that it was an all-hands-on-deck moment in which the very survival of the liberal democracy that is our national inheritance. It needed protecting and it needed defense. And we wanted to be part of that, particularly since the threat was coming from our friends or our former friends and the people we best know in the Republican Party. That introduced risk, right? So we're on the Hill primarily talking with largely talking with Republicans, though we do talk with Democrats as well. And if you'd think that defending liberal democracy and the norms thereof against the Trump administration would make that job somewhat difficult. We knew that it might, probably would, but we felt it was critical anyway. Turns out, fast forward the clock now, we're almost 4 years through now with Donald Trump, and our relationships in the Republican Party couldn't be stronger. It's remarkable. And it's not because every office we work with agrees with us about these larger matters. We have excellent relationships, for instance, with Senator Hawley's office, Senator Rubio's office. And these aren't people who are exactly never Trumpers, right? They're not. I think it's a combination of the fact that we provide valuable analytic services to staff. We help them with their legislation. We provide feedback. We're a source of ideas. And we'll take allies where we can find them. I mean, if you were only going to work with people who agree with you more often than not, we'd probably be working with virtually nobody in American politics. So, putting together strange bedfellow alliances and transpartisan coalitions is sort of our bread and butter. And it turns out that even given our more public-facing Never Trump work, it hasn't gotten in the way of working with elected Republican members. And I think maybe some of that also has to do with the fact that privately a whole lot of these members and staff agree with us, but they can't publicly agree with us, but they can certainly tolerate us.
Can you tell me a little about the public Never Trump work that you alluded to? What sort of things have you guys done?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, we, after the election, Donald Trump loaded up with public intellectuals who were engaging in the most important political vehicles in the country to push back against Trumpist illiberalism. So we are, for instance, in the New York Times editorial page more than think tanks that are 10 times our size. We have good writers and good intellectuals and good political analysts, and we open fire. And so spending resources on that, bringing in very capable academics and writers and getting them into The Guardian, The New York Times, The Washington Post, The Atlantic, these are, critical things because there is really no such thing as public opinion. There's only published opinion, as a steal a phrase from Winston Churchill. So that was one means of engagement, a serious all-out defense of liberal democracy and the norms thereof that are now under risk. The second was to rally the opposition. I mean, there were a number of Never Trump Republicans who found themselves heartbroken after the election of Trump. And we thought it important to, if not provide them a home, but to help provide them with a community to staunch the bleeding, prevent any further defections, and then to better inform what the right might look like or the center right might look like if it's not going to look Trumpist. Because after all, one of the main reasons that Donald Trump and his movement were able to succeed politically in 2016 is that the alternative creeds in the GOP had just become threadbare and dead. I mean, what was arrayed against Trumpism? What, zombie Reaganism? That had lost political salience a long time ago, and it didn't have much of a base in the party. Charles Koch, Tea Party libertarianism? Well, that was thought for a long time to have a death hold on a tight grip on the Republican Party. But the minute Trump showed up on the scene, all of those supposed Tea Party libertarians who quoted Hayek at you defected to Trump en masse. It was like the entire Koch army just put on red hats, just completely went to the other side, which told you about how much political salience that creed has in the GOP. There's obviously no moderate Republicanism anymore. The last of the Rockefeller Republicans had been executed long ago. So there was really nothing to stand up against populist nationalism in the GOP. And you can't beat something with nothing. And as a think tank, I thought that the Niskanen Center might be in a good position to help inform the shell-shocked Never Trump activists about where maybe conservatism might go or the Republican Party might go if it's going to take off the red hat. And that's a big job. So we began to host bi-monthly meetings at the Niskanen Center, private invitation-only meetings with political and journalistic elites who you might, you know, put in the Never Trump category, to network and discuss and to share information and to engage in deep conversations about what happened and where to go from here and that sort of thing. So those have been the two main engagement points for Niskanen. We've also been involved with other organizations as far as, you know, co-sponsoring this, that, or the other event. So there is a network of political actors, some think tanks, some policy activists, and then just some prominent individual actors who collectively punch above their weight, at least where it might be if they were engaged just independently.
You've referenced these, you know, some of the people you hired, writers and public intellectuals and the people that were meeting. Can you like enumerate a few of the key people that are in this fight in this way?
Will Wilkinson, a vice president at the Niskanen Center, is a columnist at the New York Times and somebody who also writes occasionally for Vox and the Washington Post and elsewhere. Will's a public intellectual with a broad portfolio, and he's written quite a bit about virtually all topical political matters. But his research focus at Niskanen, when he decides to engage in a deep dive, and he's engaged in several very impressive deep dives, has to do with the implications of the urban-rural divide, culturally and politically. I mean, it's everyone kind of understands and appreciates the fact that the Republican vote now is coming from rural America, and they've lost an ability to compete in the cities, and they're increasingly losing their ability to compete in the suburbs. So population density is the best predictor of where you are politically in the United States and why, you know, certain places vote blue and certain places vote red. Well, why is that? It's not obvious that it ought to be that way. And Will's done some tremendous work looking at the underlying sociocultural issues that tend towards conservatism in rural America today versus liberalism in more densely settled parts of the country. And if you appreciate those matters, it's a lot easier now to understand where that Trump vote is coming from and what's driving it and how you might wrestle with it. Because after all, if you want to engage meaningfully with the rise of populist nationalism in the GOP, it's critically important to understand it. Because if you don't understand where it's coming from, you will be at a disadvantage in trying to fight it, which is one of the reasons that we also have political scientists like Matt Grossman, who he's a political scientist at Michigan State University, does tremendous work on the science of politics, how policy change happens, very topical issues with regards to the Republican Party and the Democratic Party and the actors therein. So he's somebody we have on board. Rachel Bitekofer is another political scientist we have on board, who is engaged primarily in electoral forecasting today, but it's premised on an understanding of how the American electorate works, how voters think, how public opinion moves through votes, how political power is organized. And these are critical things you need to know, again, if you're going to engage meaningfully in American politics.
If you don't mind, one question on Rachel, because her work has gotten quite a lot of play. Where do you think she is right now on forecasting this fall?
Where do I think she is? Well, I know where she is. She's arguing it's put a fork in Donald Trump. He's done. Joe Biden is going to win this election, and he's going to win it fairly cleanly. It's not going to be a nail biter. That's assuming everything we know is resists some, you know, exogenous shock. Short of something critical, like, say, a vaccine dropping upon us next week and then being widely available 2 weeks thereafter and the economy booming and, you know, and another Me Too moment hits Joe Biden and then he has a senility moment. I mean, so there's a lot of things we just can't know.
It's been the year of exogenous shocks, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has. But they really haven't helped Donald Trump very much.
No, they haven't.
Oddly enough. And that's fairly controversial. I mean, within political science, you know, there are people who disagree with Rachel, but I'm convinced by her arguments. But one of the reasons we stock up on political scientists and political science work at the Niskanen Center is, again, if you want to act on the political battlefield and you're going to engage in the public policy fights in American politics, it's really critically important that you understand how politics works and you understand the political landscape you're working on. So that's why we have political scientists like Rachel Bitekofer and Matt Grossman and Steve Tellis, who's another senior fellow with us, as well as Laura Field, who is a political theorist at American University. We have a number of people who do this professionally in academia who have something to say about American politics that unfortunately doesn't penetrate that often in the social conversations.
The meetings that you were referring to, is that the same thing that other folks have talked to me about, like the meeting of the concerned or some
yes.
group like that? Yes.
Yes, that's what I'm talking about.
And so I've talked to a number of people who've attended them and who, and I've read Stephen Tellis's book and talked to him on my podcast about sort of the Never Trump movement. And that's a good source of understanding about that. How do you see the current state of basically Republican Never Trump world?
It's in flux and it is a work in progress. One of the things that I'm encouraged by is the fact that there has not been any fundamental collapse of the Never Trump movement post 2016, at least within public intellectuals, journalists, writers, institutional actors, politicians, separate matter, political operatives, separate matter. Because, you know, for reasons that Steve explained well in his book, it's virtually impossible to maintain an independence from the gravitational pull of the GOP for long if you're in certain parts of that community. But amongst writers and the kind of people we're trafficking with, they've for the most part held the faith, and that's been really encouraging. What's been most encouraging to me is an increasing seriousness about the political challenges that the Never Trump Republicans face. I think some of the myopia that lingered in that world is gone now. In other words, this idea that if we could just rewind the clock to 2014, everything would be great. No, 2014 was not great for Never Trump Republicans in a lot of ways that now they're increasingly aware of. And I think also most healthily, it's really shaken a lot of assumptions. I mean, it's very easy to go through life with a certain set of ideas about public policy and politics without having to, you know, challenge or question those ideas. But the rise of Donald Trump has been a political earthquake that has shaken a lot of these people to the core. And it's probably the only thing that might have shaken some of them out of their old dogmas and beliefs. They were in a position of one time trusting as, you know, reasonable, thoughtful intellectuals that they can no longer trust because they're like, look, this guy's got a MAGA hat on. Why was I ever listening to him? Is it really the case that there is no institutional racism in the United States when I'm seeing these people dog whistle it or Blair horn it out there to powerful effect? There has been a tremendous awakening amongst Never Trumpers about the old creeds that they had kind of, I wouldn't say thoughtlessly embraced because it was never thoughtless, but have too long left unquestioned. And that has, I think, meant that the Never Trump world, well, there's obviously disagreements within it. It's hard to characterize it as one thing, but there is a lot more intellectual curiosity. There is far less dogma. And there is no certitude with regards to ideology that governs the way most Never Trumpers are now thinking about public policy and politics. And that's remarkable, not just because, and I don't mean to say it's remarkable because the old Never Trump were a bunch of dogmatic ideologues. It's just that almost everybody in politics is a dogmatic ideologue of some sort. And so to find a large network of people who are in the busily in the process of shedding dogma and questioning ideology and thinking empirically and evidence-based and being more ecumenical about the principles that they're going to pay attention to is a remarkably positive development.
I think I agree with that. How is this affected? Like, you have to find funding. I could imagine that you're kind of in an orphaned place in American politics, but the evidence is that you're hiring people and growing and have made, you know, a thriving center. Where do you find your allies to do this?
Well, I could tell you, Nathaniel, but then I'd have to kill you. No, I'm just kidding. On our website, if you go to the About page at the Niskanen Center website, you'll find that we're totally transparent about our support above $5,000 a year. You can see for yourself who writes the checks to keep the organization going. But for the most part, these are institutional supporters, people like the Hewlett Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, Ford Foundation. Nothing too surprising, the larger philanthropic establishments in the United States find a lot to be excited about within the Niskanen Center. And we also have individual donors as well. But of course, finding individual donors who are really excited about our idiosyncratic brand of moderation is not always the easiest thing. But it turns out there are a lot of people in this country who don't put on MAGA hats, who don't consider themselves Bernie bros, and who find that their political opinions are somewhat complex, that they're progressives over here on some issues, on healthcare and whatnot, but they're not necessarily with Elizabeth Warren when it comes to, you know, banking regulation or something, who find themselves with an eclectic set of opinions and with no obvious ideological home. And those are the sorts of individuals that we appeal to.
Particularly in climate, as you talked about a little bit before, you have, you know, really evolved. And could you describe where you are on that right now? What would you like to see happen in terms of public policy in the climate area?
I don't have opinions that are very far from the mainstream opinions of the climate community. I believe climate change is real. I believe it's an entirely, not partially, entirely driven by industrial activity. That the risks are real and concrete. The damages are being imposed right now. It's the biggest threat that we face as a species in our lifetime. Not only in our lifetimes, but probably in the history of the human race. And we don't have very long to solve these problems. If we allow warming to move beyond 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, we are flirting with apocalyptic consequences over the next several centuries and possibly within our own lifetimes. And so it requires a major effort to decarbonize the economy right now as quickly as we possibly can. It turns out that the costs of doing that are less than the costs of not doing that. It's sort of like the novel coronavirus. Sure, there's a cost of locking down the economy for a brief period of time. Sure, there's a cost to social distancing. Sure, there's a cost to all of the safety provisions that we want to put in place to address COVID-19. But the cost of not doing it are even greater. We don't have choices about this. And in fact, the cost of decarbonizing the economy is only a third the cost of just letting her rip and paying the piper. So in that regard, I don't have any disagreements with Al Gore or James Hansen or the Sunrise Movement or the Green New Dealers or any of the kind. I agree with the urgency and the challenge. Where I disagree to some extent is how best to do this job. I think regulating every nook and cranny of the American economy is a job that is beyond the government to do very well. I would far prefer where we can to drive emissions reductions and decarbonization by pricing greenhouse gas emissions adequately, by making sure that people who are putting this stuff in the atmosphere are paying the full cost of the damages associated with those emissions. And if you do that, you would rapidly accelerate the transition to a zero carbon energy economy, happily, because the cost of zero carbon fuels is nearly competitive with fossil fuels right now. In many cases, is actually cheaper than fossil fuels right now. So even modest carbon pricing would have a huge impact in price-sensitive sectors. Ambitious carbon pricing, of which I embrace, would have a transformative impact in most sectors of the economy. Not all sectors. Some sectors do require regulatory attention. So I don't believe that carbon taxes or things like that are the sum and circumference of proper climate policy. But I think it needs to be the center of climate policy. And you use regulatory powers to address those sectors of the economy where pricing is not going to decarbonize on the scale and the pace we need.
How are we going to get the majority of the U.S. Senate to vote that way and to make change in any reasonable time frame?
Well, there are a lot of people who have theories about that and their theories. Here's the thing. First of all, given current rules, you're going to need about 60 votes because opposition, opponents of climate action will almost certainly filibuster any real concrete policy to drive decarbonization. So you're going to need 60 votes. Is there a world in which you can envision 60 votes in the foreseeable future for climate action? No, you can't. So climate actors have two choices, or three choices. They can either, one, accept relatively less ambitious policies that can possibly get to 60. But the only reason they're going to be able to get to 60 is because they don't impose very many obvious costs to anybody, which means that they're almost by definition not going to be up to the task, right? The second thing that is available to climate hawks is to kill the filibuster and just try to get a majority vote. But even that's going to be hard because even if Democrats take the Senate, let's say they got 54 seats, a lot of those seats are coming from places that are either purple states or they're kind of like soft red states, but they've collapsed now under Donald Trump into the Democratic category, or they're energy states, right? Like say Joe Manchin in the state of West Virginia. So it's not obvious to me just because the Democrats get a majority and they throw away the filibuster, they're going to be able to pass anything that's particularly ambitious. But that's, you know, another avenue. The third avenue is to just do it through existing executive order, executive power, right? Declare a climate emergency and then use the, you know, broad emergency powers under thereof to try to drive your formulas. Or look at the Clean Air Act, which has been ruled to govern greenhouse gas emissions by the U.S. Supreme Court. Well, do everything you can under the Clean Air Act to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. None of those things require, you know, congressional action. The problem with that is that every single thing you do through executive power is going to be challenged in court, and you're going to be running the gauntlet of a Trumpified federal judiciary, which is very corporate friendly now. What are the chances that you can decarbonize the economy completely without a single vote in the United States Congress with a Trumpist judiciary fielding lawsuit after lawsuit after lawsuit from the business community? Thin, in my opinion. So I've just painted a fairly dark picture of future action, but I'm trying to be realistic about the hurdles involved here. My guess is that the best way forward is to capitalize on the moment that the coronavirus provides us, which is a real-time lesson in the wages of ignoring science, ignoring risk, and engaging in magical thinking, and listen to crackpots in the scientific community and bad economics about what the future holds just because we want to believe something. Nobody wanted to believe that the coronavirus was going to devastate the global economy and pile up over 100,000 American dead. But that doesn't mean it wasn't coming. And it was obvious as it was coming. Same thing with climate change. And if that's one of the lessons we take from this scarring experience, I think it may provide enough muscle to Republicans, along with the fact that, you know, these low carbon energy technologies that replace fossil fuels that we're going to need to rely on, They're primarily in red states, right? I mean, wind and solar power are primarily productive in rural America. And if the Republican Party is the party of business, which it's always has been, sooner or later, the energy industry is going to become increasingly green, which means that the Republican Party is going to be increasingly interested in promoting green energy. Because that's what they do. They promote business interests. So there's a lot of reasons why you could see the Republican Party slowly, or at least enough of them moving, maybe not a majority, but enough of them moving, particularly since they need to also get votes from young people in suburban America. And they can't get those votes right now very easily. So how are you going to appeal to millennials who consider climate change one of their top two or three issues in the ballot box? How are you going to get the college-educated suburbanites who look at the Republican Party as a bunch of crackpot know-nothing yahoos? You're going to have to appeal to them somehow. And climate change is a good way they might be able to appeal to them.
That 60 vote in the Senate or other sort of pieces of the political system, the Electoral College, that are making it so that a minority can really stop certain types of important legislation that's fairly popular. I think I saw an article by one of your people, but where are you on changes to those kind of institutions?
Well, where I am personally is not necessarily where I would say Niskanen Center is, broadly speaking, since there are places where we disagree. But I think the filibuster power either has to go lock, stock, and barrel, or it needs to be attenuated so that it is once again what it used to be, which was a very rare political weapon that requires a tremendous amount of political capital to harness. In other words, if we went back to a day in which the filibuster can last as long as somebody's on the floor of the Senate reading a speech, maybe. but we're not anywhere in that world right now, and I'd probably be more comfortable just killing the whole thing. The fact is we have an extremely dysfunctional government that cannot attend to anything because the minority party has an eternal blocking power on the majority power, except for in a few circumspect positions, like when it comes to budget reconciliation and certain judicial nominees. So the game in American politics to circumvent, you know, this filibuster power in the Senate is to increasingly find ways to write, you know, convoluted and generally architecturally flawed policy design through budget bills that circumvent the power of filibuster. And it is a kludgy mess of what follows from it. And not everything can be thrown there, right? You just can't necessarily put everything into a budget reconciliation package and get away with it. So I think what we need to do is to reintroduce the power of majorities to actually govern. Now, that doesn't mean total abandonment of minority powers, minority political power, but it means that we need to recognize the idea that you require 60 votes in the Senate for most business is not an idea that you're going to find in the Federalist Papers, right? I mean, this is a modern variation of congressional governance. It's nothing that is part of our inheritance from the great and, you know, almighty founding fathers.
So do you find yourself optimistic or pessimistic at this moment?
Optimistic. Rather optimistic, actually. I don't think that Trumpist populist nationalism is long for this world. I think we're going to see it expire in November, and I don't think we're going to see it come to national power again. I think that if there's one silver lining, it's that what Trump has done is that he has broken the ice in the GOP that a lot of my old friends, libertarianish ideologues, but probably better to say the plutocratic donor base, had held that party by a death grip for decades. No longer is that the case. We now have a working class, generally non-college educated Republican Party that in a way kind of looks like what the Democratic Party looked like before the rise of the New Deal and FDR. In other words, I think the Republican Party is about to take a bad political beating, and they'll probably take one or two more at least after that, because I don't think they're going to give up the red hats very quickly. But when they do, and I think I'm almost certain that they will give up that hat eventually because the political calculus demands it, the party might be well positioned for a very productive rebirth. And the reason I'm talking about the Republican Party when I talk about whether I'm optimistic is I think right now the Republican Party is the biggest danger of the country. And I don't say that lightly. I say that as someone who spent his whole life working either directly or indirectly with the Republican Party. But right now, under Donald Trump, is the most dangerous force in American politics. And I'm fairly optimistic that it will not be that for much longer.
Boy, I hope you're right. It's a long way to go to this election, and it would be nice to see it as a real big repudiation of this man and those people that have gone along with him. What do you think of Biden?
He was not my personal rooting choice in the Democratic primary, but I'm fine with him. Look, anybody who beats Donald Trump is fine with me. And I think it's important to remember that when in office, Joe Biden might not look like the Joe Biden you expected to see. No one expected to see FDR become the FDR that we know through history. He ran a fairly unambitious campaign with very few promises, and his, you know, agenda was all over the map. And you couldn't foresee what was coming when FDR comes into the White House. You can say the same thing about so many people in politics, both here and in the UK and elsewhere. I think the moment is suited for Joe Biden very well. And I think in retrospect, he's probably the ideal nominee, given the circumstance we find ourselves in right now, at least from an electoral position. So I'm optimistic. I think he's probably the best man for the campaign right now, given the state of the country. I have no doubt that he's going to surround himself with smart and capable people. And that's all we can really ask for.
Jerry, it's been really an honor to talk to you today. Is there a question that I didn't ask that you wish I had?
Since I'm given to long and excessively lengthy answers, that's a really dangerous question for you to ask me. But no, we covered the bases I thought we'd be covering.
Okay. Well, thanks very much for your time. Anything else you want to say?
I think I've talked myself out, Nathaniel.
That was Jerry Taylor at the Niskanen Center. He's at niskanencenter.org. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at greatbattlefield.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.